Welcome to the Hospitality Mentor Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Turk. Join me as we dive into the personal stories of some of the world's best hospitality professionals. We follow the journey of their ups, downs, and wild turns to find out what it truly takes to make it in the amazing world of hospitality. Listener, if you're running a hospitality business, you already know the work doesn't stop. And most of the time, it's not even the guests that wear you out. It's everything happening behind the scenes. That's why I'm really glad to introduce you to Lodgify, our sponsor for this episode. Lodgify is an all-in-one platform that helps short-term rental hosts and hospitality operators stay organized without needing a dozen different tools. You can manage reservations, keep your calendars synced, communicate with guests, and even collect payments all in one place. And if part of your goal this year is to drive more direct bookings, Lodgify also makes it easy to build your own website so guests can book directly with you. Plus, and I love this one, they include free onboarding so you're not figuring everything out on your own. If you like to spend less time managing the chaos and more time focused on hospitality, try Lodgify with a 20% discount on all their yearly and bi-yearly plans with our code THM20. And that's THM20. Now, back to the show. Welcome to another episode of the Hospitality Mentor Podcast. Today, listeners, I'm very excited. We've got Francesco Bali here, co-CEO of Grove Bay Hospitality Group. Francesco, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I love having you on here. We had your co-CEO Ignacio on about 2 years ago, and so I'm excited to hear your story now because they're both very different just from knowing both of your backgrounds. But we always start this show off the same way. What was your very first job in hospitality?
Well, interestingly enough, you know, my partner and I both have similar career paths before we landed in hospitality. And quite frankly, we didn't start in hospitality. I didn't start in hospitality. We learned this business backwards. We ended up, you know, we're CPAs by trade. So as a CPA, I worked in public accounting for almost 7 years, Ernst & Young. And then I landed a CFO position at a company called Areas USA, which was a subsidiary from Barcelona called Arias. And they operated restaurants inside of airports and travel plazas. And so I was, I'll tell you a little bit about my history shortly here. I was a serial entrepreneur growing up. I always wanted to own my own business. I grew up around it. My father is an architect and builder, owned his own firm and took me to construction sites on the weekends as a kid. And I loved construction. I loved design. I loved owning and operating my own business, the idea of it, because he owned and operated his own firm and whatnot. So I was always a serial entrepreneur. I ended up studying something that felt like I could see a lot of different industries, which was accounting. Got my CPA, worked in Ernst & Young for several years, seeing a lot of different industries. None of them piqued my interest until I finally decided to take the leap of faith and take a CFO position of this company, Adias, which was an industry that I didn't know at all anything about. I just loved eating and drinking and going out and having a good time, right? But most people do. But I never saw it as a business, and I fell in love with the world of hospitality. And interestingly enough, I learned or fell in love with two industries working at Arias. You know, I fell in love with the restaurant world, the hospitality side of things, but also the concession world, which was another sort of revealing industry to me that a lot of people don't really think about when they're traveling. How those restaurants and coffee shops and burger places operator, who operates them and how they come to be. And so I fell in love with those two industries. I was there for 3 years that felt like five because they were growing a business when no one was growing it in 2008, during the financial crisis. And so I had an amazing sort of second master's degree with Arias and fell in love with that industry. And really that was my first hospitality job. And so imagine, I'm coming from being a CFO, understanding the numbers, the finance side, how to structure a deal, et cetera, to an industry that I don't have any operational experience with. And so we kind of learned it backwards from there.
I love it. That's a great thing. And I want to rewind a little bit. We were talking backstage a little bit, talking like we're both born and raised here in Miami. Yes. And you were going with your dad into construction. Was that ever something you wanted to do? Was that like part of the dream?
Yeah. It was, but I had two older brothers who were 10 and 12 years older than me. So time I was ready to say, hey, I'm interested in getting into the family business. Everybody was already in the family business and there was no room for me, or, you know, I found it difficult or challenging how I was going to add you to, you know, a business that was successful with one person, my father, and then two brothers involved with the business, you know, so it had to grow that much more. So it only was when I discovered that my grandfather on my mother's side was a very similar situation. He was the youngest of three brothers. The two older brothers were entrepreneurial, and the younger brother, my grandfather, ended up going to college and being an accountant and being the family CPA. So he ran the business for the family. So I connected with that one night talking with my mother, and while I was in college, kind of figuring out what I was going to do with my life. And again, I always knew I wanted to own my own business, but how there, what do I do? It was very, you know, I tried several businesses throughout high school and college, and unfortunately unsuccessful. That's part of success, is failing. Yep. So, but I was still looking and looking, right? So the idea was to land on something to study that gave me really the opportunity to see as many different industries and businesses as possible. And my father being an artist at the end of the day, but an architect and builder, you know, he always instilled in me to say, hey, you know, always be paying attention to your surroundings. You know, everyone say always keep your eyes open, et cetera, but listen to what the world is bringing you, because that might be the opportunity that you've been waiting for. And that was areas. That was really areas where I realized this is an aha moment. This is it. I'm going to focus on potentially, you know, opening restaurants on my own. And it just so happens that our sort of career paths and personal lives were kind of aligned. Ignacio and I have been friends since 15 years. We went to high school together. We went to UF together. We studied for the CPA exam together, and we're best friends to this day. But it just so happens that he also worked in public accounting and then landed a CFO job, but more on the side equation of restaurants. So
yeah,
without us knowing it, we were kind of laying the groundwork for the beginnings of Grove Bay, in the sense that our first two restaurants were one from his background, which was his Shula's days. And then the second one was an airport restaurant in Miami International Airport, which came from my days. Our landlord is actually Arias. So we bought it from another subtenant, and it just so happens that that's the beginnings of Grove Bay, and we kind of grew it from there.
I love that. I love that story, because he talked really highly about you on his podcast. If you ever go back and listen, he was saying he likes things. Yeah, at least that. He was there. All right, so you graduate from Florida, you get your MBA at FIU, and you come out and you start working right away at Ernst & Young. Is that how it worked? Like, you got recruited and started working there?
Yeah. So in UF, you know, these firms are amazing firms. You know, back then it was the Big Six, or and then now it's the Big Four. And they do an incredible job in recruitment, and they go to these colleges. And so there was an internship process, and I was fortunate enough to get an internship with Ernst & Young, and really the rest was history from there. I honestly did not like the work that E&Y the first 6 months that I was there, because those career paths are usually like 90% of the time it's audit or tax. And that's sort of the vessel that you go into in those. But the firms also have small little divisions of consultancy work, which are difficult to get into because they're not very big. Audit and tax is like 90% of these firms, and the other 10% are some consultancy like M&A work or fraud investigations and insurance claim work. And I ended up migrating from audit into fraud investigations and insurance claim work and very analytical type work with Ernst & Young, which kept me very much more engaged than the kind of work I was doing initially, which is more methodical, more checklist driven and that kind of stuff. This was more like, I got to figure out this problem and calculate how much they lost because of this, you know, insurance issue that they had or this fraud that happened or whatnot. So I really honed in on a lot of my analytical skills there from a financial standpoint. And it was interesting.
Yeah, you're there for almost 8 years. And so that work, I'm sure you learned a lot there. You got to see a lot of different kind of companies do what they do from the inside as you're working.
Absolutely. I think, go ahead.
I was going to say, so how, you know, you get to see all those things. And so when you decide to make this move to Arias that we've been talking about, or Arias, and I want to learn more about it, How did you decide to do that? Because sometimes after 8 years, you get comfortable, you get those golden handcuffs people, you get their nice salary, you're moving up there.
You know, I remember, like, Yeah, I remember the day that my wife and I were on a retreat with Ernst & Young, and it was the retreat that they would do for annual performance reviews. And I was at a manager level at these firms. It's, you know, staff, senior manager, partner. And I was at a manager level, and I remember being in our hotel room because we were about to get, I was about to get my raise and my bonus sort of package for the next step of my career at Ernst & Young. And I got it. I opened the email in front of her, and we had already been having a lot of conversations. And I told her, I looked up at her, I go, I know it sounds ridiculous to say this, but I go, it's too much money. So, because I'm not going to be able to leave. I'm not going to be able to do what I want to do from a business owner standpoint, because once we have a family, once we start heading down that path and whatnot, this money is going to be very difficult to walk away from. And I kind of knew that from the very beginning when I started working with a firm like that, because they have very clear career paths, which is amazing. They have very clear development paths. They have, which is something, by the way, that I think Ignacio and I probably took away a lot from these firms, besides the work experience and honing in our skills and all that good stuff. But from a cultural standpoint, a business culture, a company culture standpoint, these firms really know what they're doing. And we, you almost don't even know it's happening to you while you're working there, because you're one of the part of the team members and whatnot, but they're creating a company culture that you're totally buying into, and how to do that is very difficult. And so we walked away from those firms with a very good understanding of what it takes to create a good company culture. It starts with everything from something, you know, as cliche as having a mission or vision statement to core values to, you know, clear, you know, developmental paths for people and all that kind of stuff all feeds into that. And that was probably the biggest thing that I walked away with from Ernst & Young was that company culture understanding and you know, understanding.
That's amazing. I love that you have that, because a lot of groups don't, right? It's just right. Kind of fly by night, and you don't know what the North Star is. So for you having that and learning that from there, there's a lot of good things that come from that corporate world. Cause I do work with a lot of people who never had that experience and they've never had to go through that, and they don't know how to kind of hold themselves that way. And there's a lot of benefit, but also some negative things and red tape and slows things down, but it's good to have. And so for you, how did you make that jump? Right. Cause we talked about it. You have that moment. It's too much money. It's too much money. I can't take this. How did you start to look around and make that? Cause there's a lot of people in those shoes that listen to this right now. Like, man, I can't leave this role. I'm making too good of money. I have my bonus.
I'll be completely honest. The role at Adidas did not come at the time I left Ernst & Young. I decided to leave Ernst & Young without a plan.
Wow.
Because I said, if I don't try this now, I'm never going to be able to try it. So again, like I said in earlier years, I had different businesses and whatnot. This is a different phase in my life. You know, I'm probably around 30 at the time, and I decide to leave Ernst & Young and take my hack at development, real estate development. It's my family business. Most everybody in my family was architects and builders. They weren't thinking about development, right? I know, hey, I can figure this out. So I tried my first real business coming out of Ernst & Young. We built a couple spec homes. It was very challenging. And like I said, 2008 hit. Financial crisis hit. And so it was not a great time to be a developer. It was not a great time to be financing anything. And so obviously that dream didn't happen, but I learned a lot from that scenario as well. And I was sharing space with someone at the time who their client, they were a consultant bringing in new business from outside of United States. And one of the countries he was working with was Spain. And Adidas is based out of Barcelona. And they were setting up camp in Miami to set up their U.S. operations, and they had just won their first contract, which was Miami International Airport, and a CFO position opened up. And so the person I was sharing the office with shared the opportunity with me. I was on the tails of, a failing sort of development business. My wife was pregnant with our first child, and I said, I got to take this. I don't know anything about this business. I don't know anything about this industry, but I will learn it and I will do the best I can. And that's what I did and that's how I jumped into it, you know. And I kind of, really the jump happened when I left to go on my own, and then I failed, and that's part of it. It's okay.
You learn.
Rolled with the punches, and this other opportunity presented itself. And I said, you know, I don't want to be a CFO. I don't, but I need to be. And I need to be, because I'm not ready clearly to start my own business just yet. It'll happen later. So I need to provide for my family. I need to learn a new business and I need to continue forward. And so that was the leap that I took from, you know, a failing real estate development business to CFO of Arias for 3 years. And then opening our first restaurant in 2010.
And you're kind of a rock star in Arias. For me, researching, I see that you really helped them grow a lot as part of that team. I just want you to touch on it a little bit, because I don't think people realize what it is and how big a business it is and what you were doing. I think it'd be super interesting for everyone.
Yeah. So the concession world is basically all the food and beverage that you see, and retail that you see when you're walking through an airport, be either pre-security or post-security. And those concessions are operated by concessionaires. It's cornered by about five humongous operators globally and in the United States. HMS Host is one of them, which comes from Marriott days of hotel that branched off into a concession company called Host now. SSP, also an international company, billion-dollar company. Host is a billion-dollar company. OTG, another humongous company. Arias is a billion-dollar player in the global market. They're like a $300-400 million player in the U.S. market. And so that whole world is it's based on contracts. You have certain qualifications. You got to have certain financial backing in order to bid all these things. And so that's that world. I don't know if I answered your question.
You answered. I don't think a lot of people realize how big a business it is, having everything in those airports and concessions and stadiums and all these things that people kind of just take for granted. It's like, how did that restaurant get there, right? And who's running these things?
Yeah.
Right? A lot of people think it's mom and pop, right? Sometimes.
You're absolutely right. It's absolutely not mom and pop. However, the federal government did introduce a minority program many, many years ago to help it bring in small business into the industry. And it was very successful. It's a minority program called the ACDB program. And it just basically affords an opportunity for minorities to small businesses, really, to come in and partner up with these big players and operate one or two or three locations, or be a joint venture partner in the overall contract, you know? And so Arias might have a contract and locations, and they either sublease two locations to somebody, or they just bring them in as a JV partner and they put up money, but they're a silent partner and Arias operates. So for Arias, for example, they were a billion-dollar player globally, but they never entered it in 2000 until 2007. And they went from one airport to nine in a matter of 2 years. Then we were also a big component in winning the Florida Turnpike, which was a humongous concession that they, it was, you know, it's a fifth. These are contracts, especially in the Turnpike. These are contracts that are 40, 50 year long contracts.
Right.
Because the investment is $150 million. They got to develop, you know, seven travel plazas along a, you know, 400 mile Turnpike. It's a large investment. So they need a long time to recover their money and also make money off of it, right? So their business is like airports and turnpikes. And they grew while I was there. In the 3 years, they went from, you know, one contract, which was maybe doing $15 million to $250 million in a matter of 3 years. And this is, again, during 2008 to 2010 when I'm growing. You know, it was fascinating. I would remember calling people to say, hey, I need to interview for your job. You're hiring? Oh, okay.
I'm coming. I'm joining.
All right. So you do this for, you said, like 2.5 years. You're in there. You're helping develop. But I'm sure you still have that itch, right? Like, I know that as an entrepreneur, you still have that itch in the back of your brain. Like, oh, that's a cool part of the business. I'm learning that. I'm seeing this. Is that what was going on with you during that whole week?
Yeah, during the whole time. And again, you know, it's funny because, you know, I'm in the mix. I'm liking what I'm doing while I'm at Arias. I'm learning two new businesses, concessions and restaurants. And Ig and I are still best friends, right? And we're talking and hanging out on the weekends. And he's telling me about what he's doing at Shula's. And I'm telling him what crazy stuff is happening at our company. Because, again, this is a Spanish company setting up in Miami or United States for the first time. They don't even realize, you know, the ins and outs of doing business in America. So it was a learning lesson, big learning lesson for the company. But so we were sharing war stories. And then, you know, we're also... he's entrepreneurial as well. And we were talking, you know, hey, you know, what could we invest in? You know, we're finally a little bit of money. Like, what do we do? You know, and then I even remember at one point we were talking about potentially investing in Subways, you know, like, hey, let's buy a couple Subways. Maybe that makes money. Okay. Hey, there's three here for sale. Let's go look at them. We would go look at them. And we're like, man, I don't know. How much money does that possibly make, you know, and this and that. We started talking about it.
And it was just a matter of time that finally, you know, for where he was and what Shula's was doing, they approved him to be a franchisee. And for us, you know, being finance guys and CFOs and knowing the business and whatnot, it made all the sense in the world to go with a franchise because it has all the operational infrastructure thought out and built in and all that kind of stuff. So it was until then, and he said, you know, what if we open our own steakhouse, you know? And I'm like, yeah, that's a great idea. Like, I'll take it. I'll run. I'll leave. I was like always ready to leave, you know,
yep.
Obviously for a humongous pay cut, but, yep. And I would have, but by the way, I would have never been able to do this without my wife's support. She had an amazing position at a global Spanish company too, in the travel industry, making great money, but we were already, you know, one child down and another one coming soon. And I knew that those days were numbered, but she was like, do it now. I've got, you know, I'm doing well, take the pay cut and dive into opening this restaurant, with your best friend and partner and hopefully it works.
Shout out to your wife. Amazing.
Yeah. She's always been and continues to be my biggest cheerleader and supporter. And without her, I wouldn't have been able to do any of it. But that's basically how we got started.
So let's talk about that next step, right? Because you have the idea, you want to start. So walk me through how it starts. Everyone wants to hear that part. It's like, how did you guys build this, right? Yeah. How did you actually get started? Because it's one thing to go into business with friends, and it's another to actually start. You know, a lot of people, it blows up their friendship. Did you have to have big contracts ahead of time? Did you make agreements ahead of time? Say, hey, this is how we're going to do things, or was it all a handshake?
It was all a handshake. Really, the only agreements that we had in place were obviously the formal lease, the formal franchise agreement. We've been friends with someone, but one of our major investor partners. He's our primary investor partner. He basically manages all the other investors, and he's our investor partner. And we were friends with him since high school as well. We knew each other. We never talked about doing business together, but he was a very successful real estate development person, community guy, attorney by academic, has an attorney, a law firm, but that he doesn't practice. Very knowledgeable guy, very experienced, very fair guy, and very reasonable person. So all of us are now very, you know, successful and whatnot, but we always had a sort of an inherent understanding that in order to work well with one another, that especially people that we trust, again, we come from the same place. We come from Miami. We knew his family. He knew our family. Like, you know, there's that trust inherent, right? You're gonna work together and good or bad, you know. So his philosophy, which I also always took into consideration for future endeavors, is that there's no bad business with good people, and there's no good business with bad. And it's really at the end of the day, it's about the people, right? And I so it's that group that we put together for this first restaurant was really the same group to this day that continue to invest with us in our growth. And they're great guys, local guys, community guys. And we were able to raise the money that we needed to raise. But again, we realized what they would be concerned about if they were putting in $1 million, which is what we needed in order to open this one restaurant. They'd be concerned with the fact that we've never operated a restaurant before, right? So bringing in a franchise, bringing in a brand at the time, with Don Shula, the icon, et cetera, hedged those risks. You know, and I think understanding that risk up front and being real with yourself about what your weaknesses are, and then providing for solutions for those weaknesses to an investor is going to be key to them believing in you and in the business.
I love that. And a lot of people, I'm sure your friends are like, you guys are accountants. What do you know about running a restaurant, right? I'm sure those conversations might have come up, but you guys nailed it. And so kind of walk me through. You have your success there. How did this continue on?
Yeah. So after that, it wasn't until really 3 years later that we were presented the opportunity to acquire an existing subtenant of areas in Miami International Airport. It was a humongous sum of money. It was very nerve wracking. It was sort of, okay, this is going to be our second restaurant. You know, it's in the airport. We've never operated in the airport before, but I've got a great resume that says I do.
Yeah.
And we were able to acquire it in August of 2013, and it's a Corona beer themed or branded restaurant, one of the most recognizable brands in the world, right? Corona beer, who doesn't know that? And it was doing great numbers. And at the time, it only had 5 years left on its contract with 2 1-year extensions. And honestly, the numbers were very tight, but I knew from the industry that sometimes 5 years doesn't work out to be 5 years. Sometimes 5 years turns into 10 years. And so, but you don't know, there's no guarantees.
Right.
So as long as the numbers penciled for the first 5 years, which they did, they really didn't have us making any money until after year four. So we were totally taking a risk and a gamble. The business could close a year after we got our money back and we try, but now we've been out 13 years and we just signed an extension for another 15 years. So one business, you know, turned into potentially almost a 30-year, you know, deal. It was a huge risk that we took, but again, we hedged our bets in terms of the downside. We felt very confident that we could make it up within a short period of time. Growth came slow. Growth comes very slow. So if I had to tell anybody, you know, patience is a virtue. You need to have patience with yourself. You need to have patience with how long things take, even if you control them. And so you don't want to rush into things. You want to make sure that you're making the right decision. So first restaurant 2010, second restaurant 2013. It wasn't until 2016 that we opened our third restaurant, which was Glass and Vine. And Glass and Vine let me back up a sec. Glass and Vine came out as a result of us having won a bigger contract, which is where Bayshore Club is now.
Yeah.
And it's the reason why we were named Grove Bay Hospitality Group. It's the reason why we are where we are now. The city of Miami had put out an RFP for 7 acres on the waterfront in Coconut Grove, where Scotty's Landing used to be and where Chart House was, and this big old marina. And it's got all these moving parts. And we bid on it in March of 2013. And we were awarded the contract in June of 2013. But then the city of Miami charter requires any waterfront property to go to referendum, which basically needs to go to vote for the city. And so it needs to go on a ballot. And then in November 3rd, they got to vote on it. And so we were out there. We ran a whole campaign, political campaign, to vote in favor of Article 443 or whatever. So once we won that and we were awarded that, the city was very happy with what we proposed and whatnot. And they asked us, hey, can you take a look at Peacock Park? Because we need to activate that. And we're going to be putting out an RFP and we would love for you guys to bid on it. And it's a competitive bid process. Once they put out the RFP, there's a cone of silence. You can't talk, et cetera. There were three bids. And at that time, once we won that one on the waterfront, we said, let's start doing a thing. You know, I don't see us continue to do franchises. First of all, it comes at a huge cost.
Yes, expensive.
You know, we have 6 years under our belt now, 5 years under our belt now. I think we have the chops and the experience and the team, as lean as it was at the time, to present this as our own concept. And so we teamed up with a local chef, which was Giorgio Rapicavoli at the time. We signed a short-term deal with him to create the menu and develop the concept with us. And Glass and Vine was born. And so we won that. We got a lease with the city there for, I think it's 35 years. And that was our third restaurant and our first venture in terms of a proprietary chef-driven concept.
I've been to Glass and Vine many times, and my kids have played on that playground while I've had wine watching them on that playground there.
Great.
If you haven't seen it, it's still there. It's a great restaurant. And it's amazing that that's the first. But I'm just curious, when you put these RFPs, like, you guys are you're not a big restaurant group. You have a handful of places. Like, how did that in your mind be like, oh yeah, we're going to be awarded this when there's so many restaurant and hospitality groups?
Well, there, I got to hand my experience to areas again, because being, you know, working in areas, even though it was a $1 billion company overseas and globally, we were very much of an entrepreneurial small business in Miami, starting in the United States. We had this huge backing from Spain, but the team was 10 people and we were trying to, you know, and so I was very involved with their preparation of their RFP bids. And so I got to see the process. I got to see the different parts, you know, and it's not a team that's in-house that puts these bids out. They end up hiring basically an RFP writer, interior designer, a renderer, you know, furniture designer, you know, all these things to put this package together. So it's a lot of subcontracting, and I brought that experience from areas. And we put that bid together for the 7 acres on the waterfront and won it. And then we put it again together for the RFP for Glass of Mine and won it. And so it was an interesting, I guess, skill set, because you don't have it unless used to bidding on things.
Yeah, I've never done it, so you really just learned a lot just from hearing talk about that. I'm sure
because it's like these huge binders, and you present them, and they want 16 copies of them, and you know
how many trees you have to cut down to show everyone in the government. Yeah. I was going through a government process now to get something rezoned because we're opening up our first hotel, a landscape resort on a farm down here in the Redlands. I'll tell you about that after.
Oh, yeah.
The podcast. But yeah, I'm having to go through some of those things now. So it's been really interesting. All right. So to get back to your story, you got Glass and Vine. You're rocking and rolling there because it was a hit right off the bat. You got a lot of great press. I remember that. It was a hot spot. How did then you start to fast forward? Because now you're going to start opening places and you're like, you win the Michelin stars and things start happening. Yeah. How does this all continue?
So the Jeremy Ford sort of audition that set us up for a trajectory there, because we had this contract on the 7 acres of the waterfront there that had three restaurants. One was a seafood restaurant, one was a steak restaurant, one was a casual restaurant, which is the Bayshore Club now. And so we said, what do we do for the seafood restaurant? You know, and we were watching at the time, we were watching Top Chef. We saw Jeremy on TV. He was like in episode two. And Ignacio and I both watched the same episode and couldn't believe it. He had won. He was from Miami and he was talented. And we kind of called each other that same night. And we're like, why don't we call this guy? Like maybe, you know, we don't know how he's going to do on the show, but he's from Miami. He's great on TV and he's very talented. It looks like his food looks amazing. So we got in touch with his PR guy. We had a meeting with him and we started having conversations about doing a deal at this waterfront property. And all along the whole way, I got to give him, he never revealed whether he won or not, but we signed the deal when the third episode, like before the finale, and he was in the top three. So we're like, well, at least he's in the top three, and we're going to get a top three Top Chef, let alone, he ended up winning. Right. But once that happened, unfortunately, the project on the waterfront got massively delayed. There's a lot of complicated components with the project that ended up delaying it 9 years. I mean, I don't
remember how long.
We're telling you why it was delayed 9 years, but 9 years. And so the minute we saw that this was going to get delayed like more than a year or two, we're like, we have one of the hottest Top Chef winners, going on right now. He's hot. They're interested in him. They want to see what's happening next. We need to open another restaurant with him before this bigger project, right? And maybe we do something different. And that's where Stubborn Seed was born and conceived. And so a lot of the times, a lot of the things we open are motivated differently. Glass and Vine was motivated by an incredible property and an RFP that presented itself. And then we worked backwards and said, all right, what do we put there? Well, we worked with Giorgio and created a concept for that opportunity, because the opportunity was great. The opportunity here was working with Jared and creating something different and a tasting menu experience and something that hopefully will get a James Beard or a Michelin. So then we had that and we're like, all right, we need a home. Like, let's go look for one. And that's when we were looking for locations and we landed where we landed, right down, a block away from Joe's. And so that was our biggest sort of step. And at that time we were also opening Stiltsville Fish Bar with Jeff McInnes and Janine Booth. And Ignacio knew Jeff and Janine because his second restaurant hospitality career path was in 50 Eggs that did Yardbird and all that. And Jeff was the chef of that concept. So Jeff and Janine are both incredibly talented chefs and great friends of ours. And we opened Stiltsville literally a week within each other. We opened Stiltsville and then we opened Stubborn. It was September 2017. So Glass and Vine, like March 2016, then these two restaurants, September, a year and a half later, September 2017. And then we still had, Shula's happening in Coral Gables. And then we had an opportunity to rebrand it there once the franchise terminated. Also in the midst of everything, I think it was right around 2019 that we got a phone call, or 2018, we got a phone call from Marcus Samuelson. And we had an opportunity to partner with him and bring Red Rooster down to Miami in Overtown. Yep. And the opening was supposed to happen right when COVID hit, and it was delayed till about 2021. And it's still, open and operating there in Overtown, and we're partners with Marcus Samuelson in that restaurant. So that makes five in Miami, street side.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had an opportunity this past year, 2025, to open a second Stubborn Seed location in Las Vegas with a 50-50 partnership with Resorts World, which is amazing. And I consider that a street side restaurant. So when we talk about street side restaurants, I talk about six street side restaurants, five in Miami and one in Vegas. And then we have, I'm kind of going ahead of us.
Keep going. I love it. Let's keep going.
Yeah. So quick backtrack to Corona, you know, once we were in the airport, the minute we were in it, we knew we wanted more airport business, but getting into the airport business, as I mentioned earlier, is super difficult and super competitive. So, you know, we said, let us focus on building our reputation and our track record and our story over the next, you know, 5 to 6 years. And then we could revisit the airport, you know, and we'll have the experience. We'll have more restaurants to talk about, and we'll be able to tell this story that hopefully will romanticize the airports and everything. And long behold, and luckily, that's what ended up happening with airports. Airports are now skewing towards this more local community, more chef driven or concept driven concepts, and not just your Chili's, Ruby Tuesdays of the world. People want better food, even in the airports. Yeah. They still want their national Dunkin' Donuts coffee potentially or burger, but you can still give them a chef driven concept, full service restaurant experience. And so we knew we wanted more airport business, but it was going to take some time. We focused on building our reputation and history and story, and we refocused. And it wasn't until 2020 that we started getting opportunities to bid on airport opportunities. So in 2020, we created a sister company. So we have Grow Bay Hospitality, which is street side, Michelin star, you know, Michelin guide restaurants. And then we have Grow Bay Concessions, which operates restaurants and airports. And we've grown that business over the last 5 years or 6 years now to 22 restaurants or points of sale. We're in 4 airports. Raleigh-Durham Airport, Providence, Rhode Island, and in Seattle. And it's been explosive in the last 6 years.
It's amazing. So as you're looking at this, right, I'm not asking you for a crystal ball and looking forward, right? But it sounds like they're two very different operations. And I'm not asking for exact numbers, but is one definitely more profitable than the other?
Yeah, yes. You know, people ask me that all the time. You can be profit less sales in the airport than you can street side.
Yep.
And if you pass a certain threshold of sales street side, you make a lot of money. So it's a thin red line, right? And if the further you get away from that red line and you get up and the sales get to a certain point, the profitability street side is huge because rents aren't as expensive. Rents are higher in airports, but you don't need to spend any money marketing the restaurant. So more of the money in the marketing because the people are there. So, you know, all that effort, all that time, all that money you spent on advertising, on SEO, on
not necessarily
influencer, PR, all of it. So that could be 2 to 3 points, you know, to the bottom line. But at the end of the day, you're going to probably pay 2 to 3 points more in rent in the airport space or more. But so the labor model is a little tighter in the airport. You could do more with less. And also the turn times are a lot shorter. So the volume of business is the sales per hour is more crunched versus street side. You know, street side, you've got peaks and valleys. You got, you know, lunch and then dinner, right?
Yeah.
Airports are basically busy the whole time. You open at, you know, 6 a.m, you're doing breakfast, and you close at 10 o'clock at night. And you have little dips, you know, little dips.
So interesting. It's so interesting. Yeah, a lot of people say, oh, that's not what we do. But I like that you have now split them into 2 different groups, which is very clear, and you can focus on those and grow each one out in a certain way.
And I will say that we do take a lot of what we do street side to the airport. We want to be known as a hospitality company, not as a concession company. We want to be known as a hospitality company that does concessions. I know there's a difference. It's a new one.
I think it's a good way. Yeah.
And the airports are liking it so far. So,
and so how about hotels? I'm sure hotels that you got Resorts World, but you're still counting that as street side. Are you exploring any more hotel kind of deals, or is that not up your alley? I know they're kind of different than standalone restaurant.
Yeah. We explore a bunch of things. We honestly look at everything that comes across our table. We say a lot of no to most deals than yes. We've been fortunate enough that our investor partners, you know, are very happy with our business, and we don't have a gun to our head growth. So we grow at our own pace. Hotels is something we've always looked at. Hotels can be tricky, you know, depending on the size. Honestly, you need to be in Vegas or Orlando, where these hotels have thousands of rooms, you know, because that's the go-to. Everybody goes to, right? It's like, oh, you're in a hotel, so you got 300 rooms. That, you got all the business that you need.
No, you don't.
You might be capturing 10% rooms, you know, and so that's not enough unless you've got thousands of rooms.
Yes.
And you know, Orlando and Vegas have that. So it's a different business model, than if you put a hotel, you know, you put a restaurant in a hotel that has, you know, 300 rooms or 400 rooms, you're still a destination. So unless the hotel is looking for a cool concept to be an ancillary service to the hotel guest and subsidize the losses that potentially could come, it's a challenge, I think, but yeah, we always look at them.
I think for listeners too, I think I can say this is past. It was earlier 2020 before the viruses all came through. I think it was either you or Ignacio that we walked through at the Lowe's when I worked there at Miami Beach Hotel for where Rayo's is. And we were like, maybe we could do something. And the world collapsed and everything went to die wrong back then.
And that would have been a place that we would have considered for sure. Yeah. Because
you're
in a hotel, but you're not in a hotel. Like it's for its own space. Yeah. It had its own access point. It was visible from the street. A lot of those things are really important that people overlook.
Yeah, that restaurant ended up doing well. So Rayo's is doing a good job. Yeah. All right. So cognizant of time here and potentially your battery collapsing, listeners, like we cut that out of the episode, but his battery may not work. But Francesco, what are you most excited about? I'm not asking for your 5-year plan, but like in the next 12 months, what are you most excited about?
I'm excited about what AI is going to bring to the table, how that's going to develop. You know, we're playing around with it for phone calls and for potential reputation management thing. So AI is a big question mark, and how it develops is going to develop very quickly over the next, 2-3 years. It'll be adopted in other industries probably quicker, and different service will adopt it quicker. You know, like QSRs will probably adopt things quicker than just in terms of being able to implement it. I'm super excited about our landscape in terms of growth for the airport space. We're looking at several airports that are coming up that I'm excited about, some in Florida, some nearby, some in Texas. And I'm hopeful that we can win one or two more contracts and become a significant player in the space that's hospitality driven. And I'm also excited to see what continues to happen with Miami. I mean, we're patiently waiting on the sidelines. We're not in a rush to grow, but I am kind of excited to see what opportunities may present themselves in Miami. You know, we're it's our hometown, it's our backyard. We're always going to have restaurants in Miami, and we'll continue to grow in Miami, but if under the right conditions. So yeah,
no, it's very exciting Miami right now. I was just talking to a friend. All the billionaires moving here, lots of projects going up. I look out my office window here, cranes everywhere in Edgewater and in downtown. It's
crazy.
Unbelievable what's happening here.
Crazy.
And I'm excited for you to continue growing because I love your restaurants.
Thank you so much.
So my last question for you, Francesco, all right? If you could go back to young Francesco walking into Ernst & Young on the first day and whisper some advice in his ear, what advice are you giving young Francesco?
Be patient. I thought I was patient, but I was not patient. And I spent a lot of money trying to start businesses. I can tell you that much, but that's not actually the bad part. I think it's being patient with yourself and being patient with how long things take. I know I said this earlier, but it really is, I think, a virtue, and it's so important in what I'm seeing in the young workforce today that the patience is very slim. Patience for growth. You can be pretty impatient with, you know, results or those things. I think those kind of thing is fine to expect more, demand more, right? Of yourself, of your team, of what you're doing, you know, moving forward, et cetera. But patience in terms of how long things take to happen. And if you want to do something, if you want to start a business, it takes time. You know, a lot of people love to say, you know, overnight success. And it's the only thing overnight about it is the recognition. It's not the success. It's been a long time coming. You know, the first time we did one of these interviews, I was kind of like, they want to talk to me about what, you know, and I guess it was the first time they recognized us, but we've been doing it for 10 years, you know? I think patience is the most important thing. I will say one other thing. You didn't tell me, you asked me what I would whisper to myself.
Yes.
It was something I wanted to mentioned earlier when you had the opportunity. One of the big pieces of advice that I would tell the young workforce of today is, you mentioned my working in a large company. I think working in large companies is the most important thing anybody can do in whatever they want to do, whether they want to be a business owner or whatever they want to do. They need to work as much as possible, as long as possible in a large company, ideally, you know, one that's reputable and well-known and reliant. But, you know, so hospitality, you know, like the Royal Caribbeans of the world, the Dardens, these are massive companies that have made huge investments in software, infrastructure, technology. They know what they're doing. You're going to go there and just be a sponge and absorb and learn and take away as much as you can. Because these big companies will give you the foundation and the groundwork that you're going to need to build your business.
Gosh, I think that's great advice for anybody listening at any level. I think if you rewind the last 30 seconds of what Francesco told you, you'll really gain a lot from that. All right, Francesco, I want to make sure listeners, if you have not yet, go to Grove Bay Hospitality Group's website, see everything that they've got going on. If you're here in Miami or now in Vegas, make sure to dine at one of their restaurants because they do a fantastic job at every single one of them and they have all different types for you. And now you know if you're in the restaurant, if you're in the airport, which restaurant are they hitting up, Francesco? Where do we need to send them if they're in the airport?
Well, if they're in Raleigh-Durham Airport, you're going to want to hit our latest chef-driven restaurant, Crawford's Genuine. It's a full-service, amazing chef-driven restaurant concept, and you're gonna dine there and be like, I can't believe I'm in an airport, having tuna tartare and shrimp lettuce wraps.
I love it.
You're gonna have an amazing food experience and service experience. So I would definitely check that out. Also in Raleigh, we have an amazing partnership with a local coffee roaster called Black and White. And both of those are Main and Main. As soon as you pass TSA, they're right there for you to enjoy. If you're traveling through Providence, Rhode Island, we have some amazing full service restaurants there too. I don't know if everybody knows, but the Italian food scene in Providence is out of this world. And we have a restaurant there called Federal Hill, which is an homage to that area that leads up to Capitol Hill in Providence. And it has amazing Italian food by our VP of Culinary, Chef Kenny Gilbert. And lastly, there too, we have a partnership with one of the, no, not one of, the oldest beer brand or brewery in America, Narragansett Brewery. And we teamed up with them and created Narragansett Kitchen and Bar. And it's an amazing pub style restaurant, also full service and amazing food.
I love it. We got a lot of choices now. And again, listeners, thank you so much for spending the time with us here today. We shared a lot. Francesco gave you a lot of gems here. If you're at a red light, pause this, send it to a friend right now. Hit that send button because they're going to enjoy this conversation as much as you just did. And Francesco, again, I appreciate you spending this time with us. I know how busy you are building your next $1 billion restaurant empire. I can see it coming in the next 10 years. I'm going to be saying, I knew that guy. I interviewed him.
Thank you, Steve. You've been great, man. You really appreciate your time and thanks for having me.
This podcast is brought to you by Biscayne Coffee. Biscayne Coffee was founded with a giving spirit and a big idea to enjoy delicious coffee roasted in Miami while helping save Biscayne Bay and the animals that live there. As a former food and beverage director, I can assure you these are some of the best quality beans on the planet. 10% of every coffee sold is donated to nonprofits to help preserve Biscayne Bay for all to enjoy. Visit BiscayneCoffee.com today and use promo code MENTOR at checkout to save 10% on your first order. Drink good coffee and create a good outcome.